This is tape two of the Bob Dotson interview at his home in Washington, D.C. on the, what's the date today?
24th.
24th of July, 2000. And we're finishing up with the story of rescuing Pete Peterson. Mm-hmm. And you were adding an anecdote. I forget what it was.
It may come back to me on the crevasse episode.
Okay.
We can go on. And
well, anyway, the crevasse episode. That was the middle of the winter, August?
Middle of the winter. We left. He went into the crevasse on the 26th of July, 1947. We're now at the 24th, so it was 53 years ago this week.
Okay, what did you do for the rest of the winter?
August, I went with another group back there to set up a station that would last through the winds. And I don't know if we had a blizzard that bad again, but they had it manned for at least 2 weeks in August.
And you went back?
I went back to help set it up.
Okay.
Then I came back.
Who stayed there the second time?
I think Larry Fisk may have been one of them. Larry Fisk, who was a climatologist, we call him. I'm not sure of that. I think it was Fisk. The other, I don't recall. It may well have been Nelson McCleary.
Okay. And
then we had a lot of preparing to do because we were going to start our main southern sledge journey before the end of September. And here it was getting into August. We had a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of detailed preparation. You're going out for a period of, could be, as it turned out, it was 90 days. Around 90 days for both trips. We had two trips that went out, each of them 3 months long. And let me see if I turn. That doesn't help. One other detail about the crevasse episode, the British doctor I mentioned was sent instead of the American doctor because he was smaller and because he knew mountaineering. But also the British teams were selected when they offered at that dinner after I walked in for this rescue job. Also because they had had a similar experience the previous year. They'd had a crevasse fall. It wasn't very deep, but it was really more harmful, more dangerous for the person that fell in. He suffered some slight permanent injuries as a result. And there was quite an operation in getting him out. They'd been through all that, and they had set up a procedure and practice exactly for getting people out of crevasses. So we're well prepared for it.
And what was the British doctor's name?
Dick Butson, B-U-T-S-O-N.
Is he still alive?
Oh, yeah, I've seen him twice already this year. He lives in Ontario, retired now. And I saw him in Florida on the way back from the Antarctic last year.
Dick Butson.
Yeah.
Lives in Ontario.
Yeah, Hamilton, Ontario.
Was he Canadian originally?
No, British originally, now Canadian.
Mm-hmm. Where in Ontario?
Hamilton, near...
Near Hamilton.
Near Buffalo.
Oh, yeah, I know where Hamilton is.
So I saw Art Owen and Butson together, only half an hour apart.
Ah. Okay. Run out of paper here. Okay. What was next? Or sledging?
Sledging. Well, let me mention one thing before that. Still realizing the time. To try and be economical on time here. But we had several adventures that were close calls. One you've heard all about, the crevasse episode. Another, which occurred during the winter, I think early winter, was when we were setting up a rhombic antenna. Antenna that, like all antennas, has an important guideline, got wire stays, supports. I was on kitchen duty at the time, didn't see any of this. But there was one person on each of the guys as they went up, this thing going up and up. And the people running backwards with their wire, guy wires. One of them, Nelson McCleary, was one of our best people, went right back over the barrier cliff. This was on the barrier ice. walked right over this 70, 80 foot cliff. At the time he walked back over it, he had had a broken arm, a slightly broken arm, a couple of weeks before. His hand, one hand, one arm was in a cast underneath his parka. And he goes into the water. The ice, it was covered with ice, but the ice easily broke with a man's body, so the impact on the ice did not hurt him. He was lucky there were rocks all over the place he landed where there weren't rocks. He managed to keep himself afloat with his one hand. And he was another like Peterson, another tough egg. Former, he was lieutenant in the Navy, been an executive officer of a destroyer during the war. They threw him a line with a loop already built into it. So with his one hand, he just had to put it over his head, and then it tightened automatically, and they hauled him up. And all that took, I suppose the whole operation took at least 20, maybe 30 minutes. So it defied the statement I've heard before, you can't live more than 5-10 minutes. He managed to live at least 20 minutes in the water. But it took him, like Peterson, a couple of days to be normal again. He was frozen through and through, and they put him in his bunk and did everything for him. Of course, he was all right. It was a close call. Another close call happened in September. We're about September now, anyway. The big trips to the South hadn't started yet. It was in the last couple of weeks, so getting set to go. When, as part of the base laying by aircraft, the aircraft were going and laying caches ahead for the parties. And they were going across the peninsula down to a base they call near Cape Keeler, it was called. We had three aircraft. We had the two-engined Beechcraft aerial photography plane. We had a Norseman cargo plane, very popular plane in the Arctic. And all these were operating on skis, but this was a particularly good plane, cargo plane. And we had a little military cub, L5 it was called. The Norseman went ahead, and the British had one aircraft, a cub, Auster, A-U-S-T-E-R was the mate. And the British plane had to rendezvous with the American. It was part of a program. I wasn't part of this. I was back at base, but I know they had to rendezvous, and something went wrong with the rendezvous. The Norden got back all right, and the Auster wasn't heard from, not heard from at all. But we started searching, and it's to Ronnie's credit that he freely allocated our limited supply of gasoline to the search for those British flyers. We spent, the book says how much. It was a significant part of his reserve of aviation gas. So much time went by, I think it was some, again, I haven't read the book in a long time, so I can't remember exactly. It was 2 weeks at the most. It was certainly more than a week. It was long enough so you wonder how the people could be alive, because they had little, if any, survival equipment with them. Three people, Stonehouse was one of them.
I know.
And what had happened is, coming from Keeler back, it hadn't rendezvous, so I had to get home. The weather was coming in. It thought, you better get across the peninsula fast rather than go the direct diagonal route. Go across at a low pass and get on the west side and then go north up the shore. They got across all right. And then the weather got so bad that they figured we better land on the sea ice, batten it down, and wait for the weather to improve, take off again. In landing, one of the skis hit a bergy bit, something in the ice. The plane flipped over on its back. They were okay, but the plane was damaged so much that it had to be left there. So they started off, and they walked for a good week. What, 15 miles or whatever they could make in deep snow a day. There weren't three sleeping bags. Maybe they had two sleeping bags. They had minimal food, and they had a stove, I think. So they each lost about 20 pounds. And we had, I think each of us in our mind thought, we're just going through the motions, we've got to do it, but these guys are gone. And finally Lassiter found them. And when he found them, I have a photo, it's a bad photo, but it shows the event of their smoke bomb going off. This time he saw the smoke. He was in the Norseman, I think alone in the Norseman. He landed it on the ice with all the bergy bits and all. Pilot that he was, he put it down and he got it off again with all the load of them in it. And back they came.
He was alone.
Yeah, they flew that plane alone at times. I remember Adams went one alone. Yeah, I think he was alone. You know, I'm not sure he was alone, so I wouldn't like to get that down as a fact. I believe he was alone. I never heard of anybody else. He brought them all back okay. Yeah. Maybe he was alone, maybe he wasn't. I think of it now. It was a short film. They knew it was these searchlights didn't go on for very long.
So it was a tit for tat. Brits helped you, and helped them.
And we helped them, yeah. Those were our adventures. So then the trail parties. We had two major trail journeys, dog team journeys. Each one was about, mine was exactly 90 days. I think the other was about that time too. The one I went on was a two-man party, geological party principally. So we didn't cover the distance, the other one did. We were stopped for geologizing many times.
Where did you start from?
We started from Stonington Island, both parties.
Okay. And you crossed the peninsula?
No, the other one did. I'll cover this one first that I went on. My boss, he was the senior geologist. I was assistant geologist, among other things. Bob Nichols was the head of the team, and I was his helper, and I was the chief. I was really in charge of the dogs. We started with a 13-dog team and two sleds. And we came back, I think, with 9 dogs and 1 sled.
Yeah.
Oh, a photo of the start of that trip in September. Two sleds in tandem and 13 dogs pulling them. A photo of that is in the little in the corner of the Navy Museum here at the Navy Yard in Washington. There's an Antarctic section that is mainly about the bird expedition, but it's also about Ronnie's. And one of those. It's a long photo there of Nichols and myself and the team. We went down, we were on sea ice the whole time. We went down the west coast of the peninsula on the Marguerite Bay sea ice, almost to the mouth of King George's Sixth Sound, and then across to the shore of Alexander Island, and then back in a sort of a roughly circular route, though we didn't get too far out towards the center of Marguerite Bay for fear of the ice breaking up. We made sort of an elliptical circular route. And that took us 90 days. Our radio broke as it had on the plateau. It received but did not transmit. After a week or two, it broke. So at the base, they were worried about us. They sent out planes searching, and for quite a while, they couldn't find us. Then one day they did, and down came a red parachute with most welcome supplies. And they could see we waved to them that we were not in bad shape. That was our only contact in that whole time. The other trip was a longer distance trip. They had two sleds, all British dogs. We'd taken the cream of the American dogs with us.
So you combined with the British?
That was a British-American trip, American-British. Well, it was really equal. They supplied, it was their tents, their dog teams, two British, two Americans. The British were Butler, the head of the British base, Ken Butler, and Dougie Mason, a very good guy there, their surveyor. And the Americans were Arthur Owen, and Walter Smith, whom we see every year whenever we go to Florida. He lives there.
I've talked to him on the phone.
Yeah, he'd be a great one for an interview. They went about 1,200 miles round trip. They went at least 12.
How far did you go, do you know?
We went, well, distance wasn't a thing for us. We spent so many days in one place. Frankly,
so
I never measured it up.
They went 1,200 miles.
They went about 1,200. They went at least 1,200 miles.
Okay.
They went somewhat beyond the point that USAS people had gone
to. They went
beyond that.
They went over the...
Over the peninsula. To Cape Keeler. And the planes had laid caches there, which helped them. Now, they helped the planes. This was an important part of their activity, was providing ground control for the aerial photographs. The planes went well beyond them into the unknown, but their ground control was an important function. And Ardoin told me, Ardoin, who tragically died of cancer just in May of this year, he always said to me that was the highlight of his life, that trip. He loved the expedition. He loved the Antarctic.
And he was excited wonderful. About doing an oral history. I talked to him over a year ago.
Yes, that's too
he
bad.
Didn't say he had cancer. Didn't. I don't know. He didn't know he had cancer then?
He.
It was well over a year ago I talked to him.
Yeah, we had lunch with him a year ago this month, and he seemed fine.
Okay.
He seemed fine. I think
with
he
me.
Knew he had prostate trouble. He knew that.
Why
but I
that?
Think he didn't. I say the same. But he didn't last year. I don't think he didn't think it was threatening. It all developed in the fall.
We have
came
a copy
fast.
Of his diary.
Oh, great.
That his family great. Provided us. Ray Gerler is from Buffalo,
yeah.
who was my co-PI on this
yeah.
grant. And
yeah.
he, of course, was anxious to get up there
yeah.
and see him.
Yeah.
There was somebody else in Erie that also
not
was
one of our people.
No, uh-huh. he was on the 39 expedition.
Oh,
he
yeah.
Passed
yeah. yeah.
And then we had Stan Antos from Buffalo, who was
yeah.
on the IGY.
Yeah.
A couple others
yeah.
in that area.
Yeah.
We try and get people in.
Sure.
I got everybody off the red line this time. This is all on tape.
yeah.
Jackie Rani, yourself, Alan Neidel, who lives
yeah.
right over here off, well, between here and
mm-hmm.
the station.
Yeah.
The circle, what they
yeah.
call the circle here, then, anyway. Mort Rubin.
Mort Rubin. Yeah, yeah. Of our group, yeah, Adams you know about. He'd be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Plain you've been to. Peterson you've been to. DiGiorgio would be a very good one. A very good one. So would Adams. Equal.
Who's out in California?
Adams.
I got
Peterson.
Peterson, I got.
Somebody lives. Chuck Hassage. He lives in the foothills of the Sierra. I haven't seen him since the expedition. But you could try it. He might be a very good one. He was a chief engineer. He did a great job in keeping that machinery going on the ship
yeah.
and at the base.
I need a phone number for him. I can call you on these.
I've got one somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got one somewhere. Let's not forget about it. I can get you that.
Okay, well,
and,
here
and
they
you've
did
got,
1,200
you've got,
miles, the Brits and the Americans, and provided... they did some geology as well.
They
as
did some geology. They did a lot. Mason was a very good surveyor. And they did a very good, precise surveying job as they went along. And of course, tie-in for the aerial photographs is very important. And they went quite a bit into the unknown. I don't know, 100 miles, 200 miles beyond where the last party had been. And the summer months. Gee, we got back, must have been, it was the last days of December, Nichols and I. And what an easy world it was from what it had been in the winter, with the long light and the relative warmth. It was shirt sleeve weather in some days. And we were so inured to the cold, as you know, you'd be down. You'd go around in shirt sleeves where a person straight from here wouldn't do it at all.
Yeah.
I have a photo of Art Owen and I think McLean digging out that butter. And that wasn't midsummer by any means. And they were bare to the waist. But they were working so hard that it wasn't uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Windless, sun's out.
Pete Peterson mentioned that too. He says, you know, I go out in the cold now and I'll be around mm-hmm. people uncomfortable and they're freezing. And I find it on the tourist trips too. I'll be out on the fantail and a
yeah.
light jacket
yeah.
and I'll be all bundled up cold.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, and we had some good times in the summer. Summer, January and February for me. It's worth mentioning that during that time, it was before I got back. It must have been in December. There came in a number of dog teams from the British Far Northern base that was really up to the north of the peninsula, Hope Bay, and that's a long way. Hope Bay must be 600 miles at least. Well, I don't want to exaggerate. 500 at least up the peninsula. And they had come, and I think this had never been done before, they'd come down the whole peninsula, up on the part of it on the eastern side of the Larsen Shelf Ice, which was good travel, I understand. They made good time there. And then up on the plateau and down. And those who were there said it was quite a sight. And
who was
something
hitting that?
Frank Elliott. I remember his name. He was the, if he wasn't chief at Hope Bay, he was one of them. But, and they came, some of the Americans, McLean was one of them, were sent up to meet them about 2 or 3 days out and come back the last days with them. And said it was with all those dog teams. And I have pictures of them strung out, 7 or 8 dog teams. Well, it was a great sight. They said as they came down of the glacier into the base, one after the other, these guys, all brown, black from the sun, hoary from the time they'd been out, and the dogs, having done hundreds of miles, coming. It was a something you wouldn't see much of in the future. That was
exciting.
True. Yeah, great, a great moment. Well, they were around, and we went on excursions with them. And another thing, it goes in the category with the butter that was never, we never got officially permission for, and I look back on it now, I think if I'd been the leader, I'd have been against it too. Several of us had done mountaineering rock climbing, particularly one of the Britishers at our base, and Elliot. Elliot was one of the best rock climbers in England. And here you had this long light and some beautiful weather at times. And so what did we do? One day we went out without telling anybody what we're doing. We went out across Nini Fjord where there was a, there were some sharp mountains, and there was a pinnacle there, 800 feet high, from the, went right up from sea level, 800 feet. Sheer, at what, when you get, well, not the first half, but the last half was really a cliff. And we got up to the top of that thing. And I can remember at the top, you could put your, you couldn't sit on it, you could put your chin on it, and one eye could see one down one side, and one eye the next. I think of it now, ambulances could run.
Nini Pinnacle?
I think it is, yeah. I think it is called, something like that.
Did Van Valley say anything about that? Or did he,
pardon?
Did he let you go off mountain climbing and rock climbing when you wanted to?
Ronnie?
Yes.
No, the British leader wouldn't have either.
No, okay.
No, that we were playing hooky. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the British too. No, in retrospect, you know, that, was way wild.
McLean climb? He's a climber too.
Yeah. He did some too. I don't recall if he was along on that. And he may have been. So we had, and then one of the British team that had come down from Hope Bay, was a South African named Ray Adie, A-D-I-E. He later became head of the British Antarctic Survey. He was a young geologist at the time, so I was sent out for about a week with him. Nichols asked me to go, just the two of us, Adie and myself, all around Nini Fjord, I explaining the geology of Nini Fjord to him. Compared to the winter and spring sledging, that was a breeze in midsummer. The conditions were just so much more comfortable than what we'd known before. I have one picture of, it just turned out well as a picture of myself sitting on top of his, it was his sled and his dogs, sitting on top of the sled, and he'd gotten off because one of their dogs had gotten out of line. They had to use fan hitches, which are popular to the Eskimos, but you need a lot of training to work a fan hitch, and they were well trained. And this dog had gotten off. They had whips, 30 feet or so, whips. They didn't touch the dog with them, but really they lay it alongside with a crack, and that's all you needed to get the dog in line. And my photo, because the black and white photo, caught him just in his full Antarctic kit, running along, and you could see the dogs in front and the mountains behind, these peaks, and with his whip just coming forward, and both his feet happened to be off the ground at the moment of the shot.
The dogs?
80s. 80s, yeah. 80s. It's a great photo. That was not in color. So, and when we left, and jumping ahead a bit, when we left and the icebreakers came, he was the only geologist there, and he stayed for that year. But subordinate to Vivian Fuchs, who came in with a British ship. Mm-hmm. We met Fuchs on our ship before he landed. It was his first visit to the Antarctic. Fuchs and Adie made some great dog journeys together down King George VI Sound in the last year. I read about them only a few years ago.
He just died, Fuchs.
Fuchs, yeah.
I met him in Cambridge.
Yeah. So that was the story of the dog team trips.
What happened after that? When did you You know, did you get prepped to leave, or?
We were waiting, and unlike the previous year, the ice showed no signs of going out. And it was already, and Ronnie had enough, having been there before, had probably a better judgment of it than we did as to what's chances, even in January. I think it may have been probably no later than the first week of February that he was really getting worried that might not go out. So, and we did have radio contact. We were sending these radio reports back to the North American Newspaper Alliance, the New York Times, and we were getting almost every week in the papers in the New York Times articles. I have a scrapbook of them. The New York Times, was, I think, at least once a week was a column coming about our activities. Even little things we were doing were all in there. So there was quite a channel there, and they had good radio contact, and they knew about Operation Windmill, was it? Windmill? 47, 48. And another factor had entered the equation. Jenny Darlington, second woman, was pregnant, had become pregnant. So, and we had a doctor, we had supplies, she could have stayed another year. It was obviously highly desirable that she get out. So between the ice and Jenny Darlington and the presence of Operation Windmill and the radio, contact was established with the American ships and two icebreakers detoured to get us. It must have been one hell of a detour. If they were going from the Ross Sea back to, say, California, or at least Panama, at least a thousand mile detour one way to come to us, and they did it. It must have been about the third week of February. We heard the icebreakers were coming. Kevin Walton and his British team were sent out to meet them, or chose to go out to meet them, and maybe he'd just come in from a trip and was best equipped for it. He went out to meet them, and he tells of going almost right up to the ship, which you can do on the ice, and then the dog team going along and the icebreaker following the dog team, two icebreakers. And I remember that was the strangest impression we had in the whole time there, of suddenly having been alone, enjoyably alone. We loved the whole experience. It was a little bit of a spoiling effect, too. All these guys, these hundreds of sailors on each one of the icebreakers coming into our little paradise. We were glad they were there. They were saving us. Still, it took some of the adventure out of it.
Yeah.
And they got in there. Some of the sailors had ice boats, or had built them and put them together. They were out with ice boats on the ice. And they came scampering all over the base. And we, as fast as we could, loaded the ship. And one of the icebreakers backed up to the bow of our ship. Peterson climbed up the mast all the way to the top. You got a great picture of the two ships about to start, with one about 20 feet in front of the other. And it seemed like half the crew of the icebreaker was gathered on the helicopter deck at the stern to watch the operation.
Did any of them come ashore?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, they were given shore leave. They were all over the place. Then they pulled us out, and they turned us loose 5 or 10 miles out. Then we ran into brash ice, got stuck in it, and they had to come back and pull us out again. And I don't know, somewhere along, all this process took a couple of days of becoming really free, and the British ship came in at that time. I think it just happened to be coming in to relieve the base. It was a duplicate, a sister ship of ours. The British had been very impressed by our ship. I think they'd sent reports back to Cambridge.
What was the name of their ship?
The John Biscoe. There have been several since that name, or at least one since. They told us right from the start they were very impressed with our ship.
What kind of ship was it?
It was an ATA. Whatever that meant, seagoing tug. It was all wood. That was a big factor. Flexible to the ice pressure. And it was very seaworthy. Diesel engine, 1,200 tons, I think. 50-foot beam. Does that seem too small? Less than that, I think. Three of a 300 and some feet long. And it has spent the war hauling barges, I suppose, across the Pacific. A lot of low gear power. It wasn't very fast, but had a lot of power. Built in Rockland, Maine, where they knew how to build the old schooners.
What were the icebreakers?
Icebreakers were the Edisto and the Burton Island. And I remember, I think none of us had seen a helicopter before, or very few. I think none of us. They'd been helicopter, the first flight. I worked for a helicopter company once. First flight of helicopters was September 1939 when Igor Sikorsky took one up about 20 feet in Connecticut. And this was 47, 48. So they hadn't been around long. Those helicopters had fabric-covered rotors and wooden spar rotors. Would you believe it? Go up in a helicopter with wooden spars. Jeez. I found that out later. They didn't offer me a ride. They got some good photos, though. So then the British had come by, and they spent a few hours, the two ships beside each other. Nichols briefed Fuchs on the geology. The scientists talked. And off we went as the icebreaker pulled off. There was a loudspeaker goodbye from them to the Ronnie expedition. Goodbye, good luck, and God help you. They weren't too impressed with our general organization. I think we were more organized than we looked. But everything up from a Navy discipline standpoint, everything was very informal. And Ike Schlossbach, the skipper, quite a capable guy. We all had a lot of respect for Ike. The way he dressed, the way he behaved, the way he talked, was not out of the book. In fact, in Chile, in one of the ports, I think Ronnie has an anecdote of one Chilean coming aboard and being a little put off by Ike's garb and the manner and his beard and his cigar, always a cigar.
He's remembered by a lot of people.
But we made it back. We had a good navigator, this Smith, and we needed him. We had rough weather going back. Mm-hmm. It took us, it was rough.
Which port did you go into first?
Nine.
You're an early better. He's an early better.
I'm going to ask you again.
Yeah.
Okay, you made landfall at Punta Arenas.
At Punta Arenas. But instead of coming in the way we'd gone out, which was through the canals in Tierra del Fuego, we went, we kept out to sea in the very rough weather until we were due west of the entrance, so the west entrance of the Strait of Magellan. And I'll never forget when we turned, after all that roughness and tossing about like a chip, we turned, and I have a picture of it, going into the entrance of the Strait of Magellan with the wind directly behind us, and it was still strong, white caps everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so stable for a while. Oh, bliss. We got into Punta Arenas, spent a couple of days there, and then retraced our step back to, not to Beaumont, Texas. We started from Beaumont, Texas, mm-hmm. because the ship was in mothballs there. That was the whole reason for Beaumont. We went back to New York, and we did that because the American Geographical Society had been a sponsor of the expedition. I don't know, they gave us maybe some money, not much. But they had been, not the National, the American Geographical Society. It's older than the National. And they had a welcoming reception, welcoming dinner for us in New York. We had a fireboat out when we came past the Statue of Liberty. The fireboat was spraying. Shooting water up in the air in celebration. And we docked, I think it was Pier 26 in Manhattan, the lower part of Manhattan. Minuscule little ship.
You had a pretty good reception there?
We did. Although it was a shock for many of us, the cultural shock. One of the people, our radio operator, Kelsey, and nobody's heard from him in 20 years, whatever it became, we don't know. He said he just couldn't take it, a place like New York. And within a matter of weeks, he had a job in Kabul, Afghanistan, which was for him. He loved the Antarctic, and Kabul was better than New York for him.
People like that. So you wrote up your results on the testing of equipment.
Yes.
And you did that in New York?
This was about mid-April we landed in New York. 48. I spent most of the month of May in Washington writing that report. And since then, I've stayed in touch probably as well as much as any member of the expedition. I hadn't planned it that way. It's just the way it turned out. I've been in touch with the people pretty regularly, sort of networking with them.
Would you do it again?
Oh, you bet I would. Oh, that was one of the great experiences of a lifetime. That was terrific.
How did it change your life, do you think?
Oh, it didn't change my life as much as it might have. Had I gone to graduate school in geology, which I almost did, I was admitted. And I was admitted to a law school, and I'm glad I didn't do that because I don't think I'd have been a good lawyer. And I finally was on the wait list for the Harvard Business School, where Peterson went. We were roommates there.
Oh, you were?
And finally I got in at the last minute, and so I went to the Harvard Business School. But that, and I had thought, oh, I'll work out some way, I'll stay in touch with the Antarctic, but it turned out to be not practical. Whereas had I gone to graduate school in geology, then I probably would have been Antarctic related. I'd have been back numerous times, I'm sure.
Have you been back?
Only twice, in late 87, December 87, as a lecturer on the World Discoverer. And in January to March this year, on three consecutive trips for marine expeditions of this year, 2000, and very probably going back next year.
Are you going to try and make it back to Marguerite Bay?
The ships aren't scheduled to go there. The ships aren't scheduled to go there this time, as the last one was. So it's unlikely. However, it may be if it can be found out from weather reports that the water is real, the ice is out, then maybe they could adjust their schedule, but there's no promise of this. So I'd say chances are less than 50-50, but maybe it's a possibility.
What do you lecture on?
Not on wildlife. There are so many people that know so much about, although I did on the World Discoverer, I did on everything, a bit on everything. There was an American Geographical Society group, and they sent me. And I had sort of my own group, and we had 9 or 10 friends along too. So I gave many lectures there on subjects that I didn't handle this year. But this year, history and dog team, on the trail with dog teams, history and the story of the Ronnie Expedition.
Did you, when you say history, what do you cover? The old history, modern history?
Yeah, the old history.
The
history
of the IGY.
I get to the IGY, but more on the older history, mm-hmm. and particularly the history in the peninsula, Gerlache, mm-hmm. Charcot, mm-hmm. Nordenskjold, those.
I do that too. Yeah. Well, I guess we're done, aren't we?